Okay, Joe, are you there?
I'm here.
And you heard that this is being recorded?
Yes.
Great. Well, this is Patty Bechtold, and I write the blog Why Not Start Now, and also have a business called Bechtold LifeWorks Counseling and Coaching.
Mm-hmm.
And today I'm really excited because I'm getting a chance to talk to Joe Cunningham, also known as Joe the Quilter. And I want to say welcome to you, Joe.
Well, thank you. I'm happy
I first came into knowing about you a few years ago when you actually brought your one-man show to Sacramento and appeared at, I think, with the local Quilters Guild or something like that.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and I'm not a quilter, but I was really, really fascinated by the idea of somebody who was a quilter who was also telling stories. I work with clients a lot around stories and creating meaning in their lives through stories and looking at sort of the universal archetypal patterns that are part of stories. And so what you were talking about really resonated with me, and then you had the quilts too. And so I wondered if we could kind of start there about having you talk a little bit about what is the intersection for you between quilting and storytelling, because it seems like there's something really rich there in the work that you do.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, for one thing. It's everything is it all it meets there at that nexus, I think. And I have I've noticed for the last, I don't know how many years, that I gradually became aware that the way that I think about it is that people tend to tell the same story. People have a story they like to tell.
Yeah.
And some people's story is, especially some men's stories, go along the lines of, I tried to tell them, those idiots, but they couldn't see. And then you'll never believe what happened. It turned up, you know, just like I predicted. And they like to tell that story over and over. Some people like to tell the story of how they this thing was hurt and I took care of it. And they'll tell that story in many different guises, you know.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated by this. It's almost like we have a personal story or narrative.
Right. That's so interesting what you're saying, because when you talk about, you know, the man that tells the story of, well, you know, that I knew it wasn't going to work out, or they didn't really listen to me, or the other person who said this thing was broken, but I fixed it. You know, you're talking, I think, about some really universal motifs, like a very caregiver nurturing, well, I'm going to step in there and fix this, or sort of a warrior story with the man, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, well, I went out to fight the good fight, but you know, they really couldn't get what the war was about, or something like that.
Yeah, right.
And so I think that's fascinating because, you know, we aren't always aware of how deep those archetypal stories are. Uh-huh. And so when I saw you, you know, you struck me as a storyteller who was actually, you were telling a story, you were telling your own story, I felt like.
Yeah.
You were telling the story of another quilter who had the same name, is that right?
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And then you were also telling us these universal stories. And then you were also, I thought, tapping into the stories of the quilts that you'd created.
Well, maybe I should just sum up this guy's story real quick.
Yeah.
I was telling the story of Joe Headley, who was born in 1750, started out his life as a tailor, and at some point, for some reason, became a quilt maker, and then was known for the rest of his life as Joe the Quilter.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, he got married to a woman significantly older than him. They were happily married for a while, and then she declined over a long illness, and he took care of her. All these things are known. They're in the historical record. He lived to be 80 years old, And a couple of his quilts are still to be found. They're in museums here and there in England. This is in northern England that he lived. And when he was 80, he was murdered by unknown assailants. He was found dead, and nobody knows exactly what happened, whether someone had broken into his cottage when he was there to steal some of the gold that he was, the treasure that he was rumored to have stored up by making quilts, or if it was just a robbery gone wrong, or what. You know, nobody knew what happened. Therefore, there was a song, The Ballad of Joe the Quilter. There was newspaper articles and what have you. So he became known and stayed in history. So whenever you read a book about or see a book about British quilts, they always talk. They'll tell the story of Joe the Quilter.
Mm-hmm.
So when I used this story to write my own ballad of Joe the Quilter,
yeah,
and just to imagine his life. And I don't really know. I mean, this was 10 years ago when I started on the story, and I don't really know how consciously I did what I ended up doing.
Uh-huh.
Because the way I recall is that I was surprised when somebody pointed these things out to me. But I did know that, like, for instance, I have a song in there called Make Me a Quilt. And it's I was very conscious there of the thing that happens when you're an artist. People will ask you to do things for free all the time. It'll
right.
be good exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that theory. I mean, there's that thing that happens. The other thing that happens is that people will often, if you sell things, if they want you to make something exactly like an image they have in their mind that they cannot quite articulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used those ideas to create the voice of the woman who comes to him to commission his first quilt.
Mm-hmm.
So you
wrote the songs as well.
I wrote the songs.
I forgot that. That because you're a musician.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew in some ways that this opened up a door for me to sort of gleefully say things that I wouldn't be able to say otherwise. You know?
Right. And right. So this man's story was like a kind of a threshold for you that allowed you to cross into some other place that you hadn't even imagined that you wanted to cross into or could cross into.
That's right. And over the curve of the whole story, I ended up telling 6 or 8 stories about that all had come directly from my own life. And like I say, I wasn't consciously aware when I was creating this that, I get to make this thing be a metaphor for me.
Right.
And then also there's a whole layer of how it's the story of what technology does to society. He becomes outmoded in his first career, which is he's a tailor who specializes in waistcoats, and they go out of style. And all of a sudden, he has no more career, and he has to refashion his life, which is, you know, this high-tech story. So
right.
there's any number of strands that all came together in there for me without me consciously thinking.
Right.
I was just making it all up, you know. And
isn't that interesting, though, that we think that we're just – I mean, I've had that experience, too, in my work, where I think it's just all kind of – you know, stuff that I'm dumping out of myself.
Uh-huh.
But then when I look back, there's sort of a through line.
Yeah.
And it's like we're, like the deeper story almost is guiding us, whatever the universal story is.
Yes.
And when you talk about, you know, how technology affected this man's work,
uh-huh.
you know, and then you talk about your own, His personal experiences, your personal experiences. Oh, that was my doorbell, but that's okay. I won't answer it. there's a real sense of individual experience as well as kind of collective experience. And I love that about what you do, that there's something there that resonates with all of us. And and I wanted to also talk a little bit about the quilts themselves, because, you know, so two, three years ago, I don't know, in Sacramento, you were here, and I thought it was just great what you were doing. And then, lo and behold, a few weeks ago, we're at the De Young Museum, and we to see the King Tut exhibit, and we see Joe the Quilter is the artist in residence, you know? And so that was like searching all over the museum for you, finally finding you. And it was one of those great moments for me because I got to, you were sitting there making a quilt, and there was such an improvisational quality to it, it seemed like. Like the quilt was letting its story tell, or letting it tell you what story it wanted to be. I mean, I know you were there too. You're the artist, of course. But it seemed like immediately there was some sort of, it was different than just, you know, piecing together a quilt. It was sort of an expressive art, it seemed like, that had a story to tell that you were letting out. And I wondered if, I think I mentioned that to you, and I think you said, yeah, that is kind of true. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, yes. What I was trying to do at the museum with every part of my installation there was, without having to use words to describe it, I was trying to convey this this idea that I try to live by and to create art by, which is that you don't have to know what you're doing. You don't have to wait until you know what you're doing in order to start doing something. That you can find out what you're doing in by doing it. So
you can find out as you go along.
As you go along, you can find out what you're doing. So there, I had this design wall there with a bunch of fabric scraps, and people could. It's just a felt wall, is all it is, like you would have in kindergarten. And these fabric scraps in different shapes would stick to it, and shapes and colors and sizes and everything. So I had people, I would point that out to people, and then they would just make a design, anything that came up to them. And sometimes people would, the last day that I was there, a woman said to me, oh, no, I couldn't do that. I don't have a creative bone in my body. And I, all of a sudden I became, who did I turn into? I don't know. I turned into a weird dude who I don't even know. I said, oh, what you're saying is not true, and I can prove it's not true. I don't know who was talking. That's not something that I would ordinarily say. But anyway, like a huckster salesman or something. And I had nothing to sell, you know. I can prove
but
it's
you
not
were
true.
Selling, you were selling belief in her creativity.
Yes. And I put a square, a triangle, something up on the wall, and then I turned around and I turned my attention to other people, and then I just got involved in what I was doing. 15 minutes later, I looked back, and she had created this beautiful design up on the wall. She just got involved in picking up fabric and sticking it there. And so that was what I was trying to exemplify there. And my quilts that I'm making now, I'm using the that idea. So, and yes, you're correct. So what the idea that I'm using is that you can trust that it will turn out all right.
Yeah. I just, right before you said that, I wrote down the word trust. So we're having we're having something.
That's right.
A wavelength going on right now. And that word is so huge for people.
Yeah.
Because it implies, you know, hope and optimism and a lot of times when I work with clients, there's a sense of not really knowing how to get back to that. And I mean, I think it's something we all have when we're children, but as we become adults, that ability to trust that, just what you said, whether it's a quilt or it's life, we're going to be able to, you know, trust that it's going to unfold the way we need it to, and it's going to be a beautiful thing. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that word, trust. I mean, or not even the word, but the concept of it, because you seem to have a great sort of reservoir of it. And where does that come from? How do you access that?
Well, let me see. I think there's a couple places that I could think of right off the bat. For starters, in the big picture, there are, people are soothed by different things. And in general, in my work as a teacher, I see that people's minds are soothed. Some are soothed by knowing what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if they have a pattern they can follow, and step-by-step instructions, then they can rest, and then
mm-hmm.
they can just go ahead and follow that, and they can enjoy the process as they go along.
Mm-hmm.
And other people are soothed by not knowing what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an extreme case of that.
Right.
I really, in fact, prefer not to know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And once I figure out what's going to happen, then I am uninterested in it any longer. And then
mm-hmm.
I get anxious, and then I
mm-hmm.
start second-guessing it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm.
I do have this reservoir of trust that it's going to, I mean, I wouldn't be able to live like this if I didn't think like you were saying, if I didn't trust it was going to turn out all right.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think part of that also comes from, so it's the way you are. And I think, really, I wish I could say it's because I am so evolved or something. And it's not that at all, I don't think. I think partly you get a leg up on this. My position in my family was that everybody thought I grew up in mid Michigan on a dirt road and I never heard of anybody that had gone to college, for instance.
Uh-huh.
It just was not in my culture at all. My
mm-hmm.
dad worked for Buick for 36 years putting starters on Buicks, and my mom came from a little farm town in northern Michigan. My reputation in the family from the time that I can remember was Joe is the smart one, and you just never know what he's going to do.
you got a lot of validation early on, it sounds like.
A lot of validation early on.
Uh-huh.
And so in a way, I was sort of shaped to be this extreme like that. But,
oh, wow.
But I think that everybody everybody has the potential to tap that idea of trust, but it involves letting go of your desire to know how it's going to turn out, and to be willing to improvise.
Yes. Yes.
And it's I don't know the steps that I know that when you can sort of trick people into it, when you can say the right words that unlock that for them,
right.
It can happen for anybody.
Yeah, and I don't think there are any steps, but you know, hearing you tell your story, I mean, if there were steps,
yeah.
We would all be millionaires. I've often thought that, you know, if when somebody said to me, I don't, you know, I might do this if I knew it was going to work out right. I mean, I can't tell you how
right.
many times I've heard that in the 10 years that I've been doing the work I'm doing. And so, you know, you're talking a lot about that, being soothed by knowing what's going to happen and, being soothed by not knowing what's going to happen. I think that many people have this belief that if they just know what's going to happen, then it's all going to be all right. But how many times in life do we know what's going to happen?
And it's also, I think that's all correct. And I think it's a matter of control, partly. People
mm-hmm.
want to feel in control of their lives, and they want to
mm-hmm.
feel in control of their destiny, and they don't want to give up that feeling of control.
Mm-hmm.
That's at least in some cases, that's the big scary thing there.
Right. Absolutely.
They like to be in control,
mm-hmm.
and I really like to be out of control. And sometimes I get, I just completely fall on my face because of it. I
mm-hmm. Well, that's something that's interesting, what you just said, because there have been times in my work doing writing and performing and counseling and coaching and some other things where I did have fear about how it would turn out
uh-huh.
until I finally got to a place, I don't know when this started, but I realized that I could say to myself, you know, it's okay if I'm bad at this. It's okay if I suck.
Right.
And I did sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is like you're acknowledging that it's okay to fall on your face, you know.
You read that over and over, don't you? In all of the literature in this area, people always say you can't be afraid of failure. You can't be afraid of failure. And I think that's one of the faces of creativity is that as long as you're afraid of failure, primarily, I think, you're afraid of, I mean, it's embarrassing to fail. It's embarrassing. And so you're thinking, what will happen if I fail? What people will laugh at me? These are incoherent feelings, but you're afraid of what you will look like, and you're afraid of. And as long as you have those thoughts in your mind about this will be bad if I fail, and then you're sunk. In a way, it's very hard to create. It creates a fog. I know this firsthand because I started playing guitar when I was 7 years old. I'm 57 now. I've been playing guitar for 50 years.
Wow.
And I made my living from the time I was 15 till the time I was 25 as a guitar player, a professional guitar player, playing in nightclubs and everything, 26, 27. And then there was an overlap period after I was 26 and I found quilts. I still supported myself through guitar playing while I changed into becoming a quilt maker. But by the time I was 30, I was making all my living from quilts.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I've continued to play all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And I can play actually quite well. I'm no genius or anything. I'm no Andre Segovia. I'm no Doc Watson, but I'm a darn good player.
Mm-hmm.
When I pick up my guitar, if I'm not singing, if I'm just playing my guitar and I hit a chord, then the voices start right inside my head. Nice note, man. Why don't you practice once in a while? Oh, gee, give me a break. Why don't you tune this thing up? All of that stuff starts right up for me in my mind. And
that inner critic.
That inner critic.
Yeah.
And it's really and if I could unlock if I could shed that the way I have in quilts, where I have ways of just letting that inner critic just go away.
Uh-huh.
But I'm always trying to prove that I'm a good guitar player. While feeling that I'm not, I always have this. So I'm feeding this cycle every time I play guitar. The only way
that's
I can get around
fascinating
it,
that
I,
you're it, saying you yeah. you've shed it in terms of quilt making, but you can't do it in guitar. Why do you think that is?
I wonder. Sort of a habit of being like. When I learned guitar when I was so young, and I formed these images of myself as a a fraud. I can fake my way through jazz songs.
Right.
I can
you constructed a story around it, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And so
that's interesting.
And then when I took up quilts, I read every book that in 1979. I read every book that had ever been written about quilts. I gave myself like a college education in them, and I became really expert at certain parts of quilt making, and I became proficient at all parts of quilt making. And so I gave myself a confidence that I'll...
Yeah, you educated yourself in a way that you wouldn't feel like a fraud.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
But the even though you were playing guitar since the age of 7 and are a good guitarist, it sounds like you didn't equate that with an education.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
I never did. That's right. I never gave my...
I wonder, too, is, you know, there's so many other musicians and guitar players. There is only one Joe the Quilter. I mean, you chose something very unique, and the way that you create quilts is very unique and different from the quilts that we normally see.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something there about you really grabbing this thing and making it your own?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. I crossed a threshold a few years ago when I realized that all of the quilts that I, like the quilts that I made for the musical that you saw, the Joe the Quilter musical, I wanted to imitate his quilts, the two that I have seen pictures of, and then also to make quilts that could have been made around 1800.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these elaborate historical sort of plays on historical themes, and
mm-hmm.
they have all these references to other quilts, and they're these intellectual kind of constructs that
mm-hmm.
I realized after it was all over that I had done specifically to demonstrate my credentials.
Yeah.
And so that when I go out there and show these quilts, I know that they're really powerful in some dimensions, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that and in any event, nobody's seen anything like this. And in any event, they're all hand quilted by me.
Right.
And this is such a rare thing that I knew that that it would be impressive enough to people that it would this an accomplishment, these six hand quilted quilts, that then it would allow me the freedom I hoped to let the people then accept the crazy aspects of these quilts, because they're all kind of crazy in their own ways too.
Yeah, I love that about them. It seems like that really worked for you, to sort of ground yourself in this historical perspective
mm-hmm.
as a way to then give you that freedom to be as wild and crazy as you wanted.
But then, 5 or 6 years ago, well, in 2006, I guess I made a quilt that was not based on anything historical visible, although there were still these threads connecting it. And then after that, I started using this, I mean, on that quilt, I started using bias tape, this commercial product that you use for bindings or something. And I started just sewing freely with that. And then I came up with this big idea, which was, what if I made a quilt that was not trying to please, not trying to impress, not trying to do anything? What if I just did something that amused me, and
mm-hmm.
that would be so simple, and that anybody could do it, but I'm the only person who would do it, right? I made this one quilt that's very significant to me that is just a few pieces of bias tape on this big white field. It looks more like a moving blanket. It has much more in common with a moving blanket than with a work of art in some way.
Uh-huh.
It just has a few lines on it. And I
uh-huh.
love this. I never get tired of looking at it.
Very significant to you because it was the sort of turning point?
It was. It was.
Uh-huh.
And since then, I've been able to make all of these quilts that where I shed that idea of trying to demonstrate my credentials.
Uh-huh.
And now it's a scary thing because now I have this whole body of work, and I'm ready to, and I go out and do lectures, but I still feel that I have to show my old quilts to get people on my side before they can see these alienating. I think some of my new quilts are alienating.
Interesting.
I'm still insecure. Yeah.
Right. No. Yeah. And I had this experience once with some of my work. Well. First, I'm going to preface this by talking about this universal story. You've probably heard it, the hero's journey story.
Yeah.
Where the hero kind of leaves the known world and goes off into this
uh-huh.
Kind of enchanted, strange world where he or she meets up with magical people and allies and talking animals and enemies and wizards and, all that kind of stuff. And usually is going to retrieve something or get something. And often before they can do that, they have this dark night of the soul where they're at that point where they're about to give up.
Right.
And so many creative people I know have had that kind of experience.
Yeah.
And I had one where I was doing this work, these workshops and things that I'd go to conferences and nobody would come to them. And I was saying to my husband, I'm not really going to do these anymore. I just don't think anybody gets it. And then the very next day, this man in my field came up to me and said, you know, you're doing something different from what everybody else is doing, and you need to keep doing it. And he was right. And I said to him, well, I was going to give it up, and I get really insecure. And he said, well, that's because you're an artist. And it was like, okay, oh, yeah. And so I wonder if you've had that kind of experience where you've been sort of on this precipice thinking, oh, nobody gets this, and why am I doing this, and had something kind of, some gift or something come out of the blue that kind of turned you around?
Well, it was enormously validating to have the De Young Museum buy a quilt from me,
mm-hmm.
and to give me this residency there, because I've been making quilts for 30 years, and I'm pretty well known in the quilt world. You know, I've written a lot of books and magazine articles and stuff, so
mm-hmm.
I'm well known in the quilt world, which is this sort of a, I call it a ghetto. it's separate from the art world completely. You know, it has no
right.
institutional connection there. And to be recognized in this way by the art world, by the legitimate art world, was huge. And it came right at this moment here for me where I've almost completely cut my ties to those old quilts that I used to make. And
yeah.
I have this whole body of work. It has nothing to rely on except I made it, and I'm the only one that could have made it because
mm-hmm.
of my life experiences. That's
mm-hmm.
all, you know. Not that they're so supreme or grand or anything. It's just that they're unique, like everybody's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they have going for them is mm-hmm. that they're unique. And
right. But that was like when you really that's the story when
that's
you
it.
Let go and you claim.
Yeah.
I think they call it claiming the boon in the hero's journey, where
yeah.
you let go of all that other stuff and you say, this is really it for me. Quilting is
yeah.
not about what everybody thinks it is.
Yeah.
It's about an expression of art for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
That's wonderful.
Mm.
That's a great story. I thought it was just fantastic to find you at the De Young.
Mm.
I want to circle back to something that you said, you know, when you were talking about the first bias tape quilt that you did
yeah.
with the lines and the simplicity of it.
Yeah.
There's another quilt that you did that really touched me that I saw up close there at the De Young, and I think it's called The Way Home.
Yes.
Yeah. And I write a lot about home and the concept of, you know, home is both inner and outer, you
yeah.
know, and so often when people are in transition, they think it's about, you know, the external, but it's really about coming home to themselves.
Right.
And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that quilt, how it came about, what it meant for you, that
yeah.
kind of stuff.
I had finished this 4-year process of making all the quilts for the show, my musical.
Mm-hmm.
And the Joe the Quilter quilts. And I was sick to death of making these historically oriented constructs. I didn't want to make another old-fashioned quilt. And I had a big piece of lovely fabric that was just it was a wax batik from Africa. It's just
mm-hmm.
it looks like this honey colored piece of fabric.
Yeah, it's amazing fabric.
I love that stuff. And I live here in the Presidio of San Francisco, where I'm surrounded by eucalyptus leaves. And I decided they're so beautiful. I love the shape and the colors of them. And I've never lived. I mean, I'm from Michigan originally, and I'm astonished at this beauty of these leaves every day. And so I decided what I was going to do is I would pick up a different leaf every day on my way to the studio, or two leaves, and applique them on to this honey color thing. And I would know that I was done when it was covered up with leaves. So that I didn't have to know what it was going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
I would just trust that, you know, when I look at the ground in the forest, it's beautiful because it's covered with leaves. And I thought, if I just cover this piece of fabric with leaves, it'll be beautiful.
Wow.
It'll be beautiful. And when I got it done, it was just beautiful. And I thought, well, that worked out about as well as could be expected now, didn't it? And so then I wanted it to be, I like to make my quilts about 6 feet square, and it was about 40 inches by 6 feet. And so I needed to come up with the rest of the 32 inches to make it 72 inches. And I had this brown fabric with white horizontal stripes, and I added that on to be underneath the leaves. And I thought that I could just then hand quilt. If I hand quilt it, it will be impressive and interesting enough. And it was not, I looked at it hanging up on the wall, and I thought, well, that's just not enough. It needs something else. And I found at the next week down at Britex, the famous fabric store here in San Francisco, bias tape on the spool. Now, quilters learn when you, it's one of the fundamental skills of quilt making is learning to make your own bias tape, because you want to make it out of the fabrics that you want so that it will do what you need it to do in your quilt design.
Right.
But so commercial bias tape has fallen out of favor. This is just a perfect white line, a quarter inch wide, and I saw it, and the idea sprang into my mind. I guess I could explain why it did, but anyway, it doesn't matter. I thought, I could buy this, 100 yards of it, and then I could just scribble with it all over that brown and white, and where the white of this bias would intersect with the white horizontal lines of the brown background, something interesting might happen. But in any case, I could just, I'm curious to see what would happen if I just scribbled all over that piece of brown fabric with white bias.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, and as I was doing it, I realized that I was, what's very funny about living in the Presidio, this former military base, is how crazy the roads are here.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that this is what it looks like in people's minds when they, when you tell them that you live in the Presidio, they see this winding craziness of the of this line. So it all made sense to me. And so then I knew exactly what I was doing this time. I knew that this quilt signified a break with the past, where I had been going along for 25 years, 26 or 7 years, proving all the time, proving what a great quilt maker I was. And that this was a step off from that path and on into unknown territory, which I recognized at the time was home for me.
Yes.
I'm going to, no, oh, now, if I can do this, I can go home.
Wow.
You know,
that's such
a
great story. I just love that story because it captures, it captures both the inner and outer home. You know, it captures those leaves that you see every day, you know, from the eucalyptus trees, and it captures the winding roads and the Presidio, but it also captures like coming home to yourself. It's big.
It's
no wonder I was so taken by that quilt. I love that story. That's a fantastic story.
Oh boy!
Wow.
Yeah.
So before we wrap this up, since people are going to be listening to this, I hope, you know, I know that you teach as well, and what you're telling me is so interesting about how you've made this turn in the road to come home to what's really important to you and your work. And I wonder, is the teaching that you do, so your work is art, your quilts are art, and they come from you and they're unique. The teaching that you do, is it related to that in some way, helping people?
Well, it is. I've written a whole series of classes that I'm having a little hard time selling. I'm really relating to your story earlier. but I keep trying to find the right description, and I teach the same class over and over under different guises. But and it basically goes like this. I tell everybody to bring a bunch of fabric and a sewing machine, and everybody wants a sample. And I've made the mistake of giving samples for this class, and then they think that's what we're going to do, but they're not right. Because what we're going to do is I'll say, okay, cut a piece of fabric about this big. And they'll all say, how big is that? How big? 6 inches, 8 inches, 9 inches, and I'll refuse to give dimensions. And I'll say, now cut it in half. Or,
so you're forcing people out of their comfort zone.
Out of their comfort zone. And I'll say, cut a corner off, put a strip in there, cut it in half and flip it over or something. So I think up three or four steps of what I want you to do to this piece of fabric that you initially picked out. And once every, and so that whole process of getting going in the morning takes about 20 minutes, and we make our first block. And then I say, okay, now do that 24 more times. And then they can't believe it. You know, where's my handout, for one thing? Where's the what am I supposed to be doing? What is it going to look like when I'm all done? What do you mean, do the same thing? And when you say do the same thing, do you mean I have to measure these and do it? And I explain to people that if I have to, I'll explain, no, I don't want you to measure anything. I want them all to be the same, because you're going to be doing the same three or four steps. And then I want them all to be different, because you're going to be just making each one individually. We're not mass producing them. And I want you to make each one individually. Take a piece of paper, a piece of fabric, cut the corner off, put a strip in there, da-da-da-da-da. So once they get the idea that's it, I'm done talking, then they start working. Well, it's tense, because it's weird. They've never done this before. And by about 11 o'clock, if we start at 9, then by about 11 o'clock, they are gleefully swatting me away from their tables. I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. All of a sudden, they are the expert in this quilt that they're making, and what do I know about it? For the most part, is the feedback that I start getting from them. And then by the end of the day, everybody has done something that they didn't visualize in the morning. They had no idea what it was going to be like. I had no idea what it was going to be. Nobody was in charge of it except for them, and it turned out that they were having fun working.
Wow.
I love this class, and I have 100% success with it every single time. And although there are times when I realize at the end of the day, I could have told that person earlier on to use less purple or something. I could have given
where your artistic eye comes in and sort of wants to be heard.
That's right.
It sounds like.
And so by means of teaching that class, so then I have to walk around all day and talk and answer questions and just improvise. I just figure out some way to pass the time. So
but isn't that the great thing about teaching, when they can go ahead and get to the point where you don't have to do so much?
And they can be really experienced quilt makers. They can be brand new quilt makers, and this process is still going to lead to the same territory, which is
when you describe it, it sounds more universal to me than just quilt making. It actually sounds a lot like there's an undercurrent of teaching people how to be soothed by not knowing what's going to happen. Coming back to what you said,
that's my whole message to the world. You don't have to know. Sewing without knowing, I call it. You don't have to know what happened.
I wrote a whole thing about why it's okay to not know and to say, I don't know. Because so often, people say, well, you have to know, or you have to have an answer to this question. But you don't really always have to have an answer to the question. You just have to go forward. And there's so much of that in your work. It reminds me of that poem about living the questions. I can't remember the whole thing. But it seems like that's what you're doing in your work. You're creating that in the artistic work that you do with your quilts, but you're also teaching people that. When they come to learn from you.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
That's what you're trying to do, too.
Yeah, it is. We have a lot of similarities there. No wonder I had that moment of and I thought, I need to talk to Joe and write on my blog about him. And that was the serendipitous thing. That was sort of one other thing I wanted to ask you. That happens to me a lot, where serendipitous things happen. Especially when I'm in that place you're talking about, being soothed or being okay with not knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Do you find that as well?
Yes, I find it like I noticed this many years ago when I I had a theater company with a friend of mine, and we would book a hall like 12 weeks from now, and then we would start talking to other musicians and actors and jugglers, and we would start putting together a show, and I would start writing music and then rehearsing it with the band. And so I have a deadline. It has to be done in 12 weeks. And it would put me into a place where, well, I have to create, and I can't let everybody down, and so I just will. I'll be able to write all these songs, which I always was able to. But I noticed at that point that if I was in that state, then everything makes sense. Everything is suggestive. And so you see the billboard, and you go, oh, well, that's exactly what I was talking about this morning.
Yeah.
Right there, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fence post. Oh, my goodness, look at the arrangement of cars in this parking lot. It's unbelievable. And did you hear what she just said to me? And, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Allowing everything to make sense. And so the more I can do that in my work, in quilts, and the more you have to stay open to it. I mean,
you do.
The more I stay open to things, then, and the more I trust things, and the more I stay open to them, and then the more that happens.
Yeah. I love that way that you phrased it, allowing everything to make sense.
Yeah.
Because when you do that, there is such a, so many opportunities for serendipity to come your way, and for you to feel that movement that comes along with it, and those aha moments. That's a great way to put it. Because there is a giving in. You do have to allow it.
You have to allow it. You have to open your heart to it, and that's what I keep. In the big picture, I think that's the goal for all of. For me, is to have an open heart, to be open and open to the world. This is what I'm after.
Mm-hmm. So is that the advice that you'd give to people who want to live a more creative life? Because so many of my clients want that. Is that what you'd say to them?
I guess I would. I would say to open your heart. However, I don't know how to do it, but I know if you can find a way to trust that it's going to be all right. Whatever happens, it's going to be all right. And to trust that even if this thing that I allow to happen turns out to be a failure, by any measure or all measures, it's still all right and useful. And so if you can just allow that, then you know what will happen, I think? The universe comes to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you open your heart in that way and you just take one step, you make for every little step that you make towards that place, the universe takes three steps towards you. And hands you so much. That's been my experience anyway, and maybe I'm just extraordinarily lucky.
No, I think that's a universal story, because you're talking about that trust, and I mean, it's lovely to hear you talk about it, and it reminds me of Joseph Campbell when he talked about when you get on the path. I mean, I don't know the exact quote, but there will be invisible hands helping you along the way. And it's like you're saying, allow yourself to go forward and trust the path, and the universe will come and guide you.
It will. I just feel it all the time, and the more I can trust, the more I get guided.
Mm-hmm. So trust, really, a lot of what we're talking about comes back to that.
You don't have to control everything, and you don't have to know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has really been exciting and fun and creative just to have a conversation with you.
I feel the same way, Patty.
Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop the recording.
Okay.
And then I'll come back on the line and we can say our goodbyes.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Figure out how to do this.